final days as Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo declares that he will be designating the Houthi movement as a foreign terrorist organization and specially designated global terrorist entity. This sadistic, cowardly move by the Trump regime received widespread condemnation from virtually everyone. NGOs, relief agencies, and even U.S. politicians. One statement from U.S. Senator Todd Young condemned the move, saying that with this designation, the world's worst man-made humanitarian disaster will go from bad to worse. Lives of innocent Yemenis and our own national security hangs in the balance. One of the relief agencies working in Yemen, Save the Children, made it clear that the U.S. terrorism designation threatens children's lives and places thousands of children at further risk of starvation and disease. With 80% of the Yemeni population living under Houthi territory, designating the Houthi government as a terrorist organization means that the overwhelming majority of Yemenis will suffer even more. These sanctions will make it harder to import food, medicine, and other critical supplies. Mark Lovecock, the United Nations Emergency Relief Coordinator, gave his comments on the situation in Yemen earlier this month and made very clear how sanctions would impact civilians, making it harder for them to buy food and further worsening the humanitarian situation, which is already in tatters.
That Yemen imports 90% of its food, and that nearly all that food is brought in through commercial channels. Aid agencies give people vouchers or cash to buy commercially imported food in the market. Aid agencies cannot, they simply cannot, replace the commercial import system. Already, Yemenis are crowding into markets and shops to stockpile whatever they can afford. Families are terrified that no more food or other supplies will make it into the country. Some suppliers, banks, insurers, and shippers are ringing up their Yemeni partners and saying they now plan to walk away from Yemen altogether. What is the likely humanitarian impact? The answer is a large-scale famine on a scale that we have not seen for nearly 40 years.
Although the United States pretends that these sanctions will only affect a few individuals, this is simply not true. The reality is that sanctions dissuade third parties from engaging in trade and commerce with the entire country. People working in trade and finance and commerce will be more reluctant to do business with Yemen for fear of being fined or placed on a list by the U.S. Sanctions also make it much harder for Yemen to obtain foreign currency, most notably U.S. dollars. And since roughly half of transactions in the world take place in dollars, this means being cut off from a very significant portion of the market. As Janti Sarepto, the president and CEO of Save the Children, says, with this new policy, the Trump administration has effectively prohibited certain interactions with the de facto authorities in the north. Many fear that businesses such as banks and shippers will avoid working in Yemen for fear of violating U.S. law, resulting in widespread shortages of food, fuel, and other essential medicines. Yemen is a country that already imports most of its food, hence why it is vital for them to have access to foreign currencies and be able to do trade, especially when the majority of food doesn't come through aid or relief agencies. Although the United States claims its sanctions don't target humanitarian endeavors and outlines exemptions for relief, we know this simply doesn't translate into reality. In the case of Syria, for example, the United States said the same thing in its Caesar Act sanctions, and one can see how that's going. The currency is in free fall, the economy is plummeted, and people are forming bread lines, queuing up for hours every day in a country that was once self-sufficient and a net exporter of wheat. And even then, Syria, despite everything, was still in a somewhat slightly better position. Yemen is unfortunately not so lucky and has been neglected and forgotten by the world. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Joining me now to talk more is Runi Agarhus, who's co-founder and general director of the Yemen Solidarity Council. It's good to have you on. Thanks for taking the time. So can I get your initial reaction to the United States designating Ansarullah, the Houthi movement, as a terrorist organization?
The designation is unfounded, based on plenitude of immoral and false allegations that has been going around about the movement for at least the past 5-6 years, or even earlier on, like 10 years, that the movement is a quote-unquote Iranian proxy, which is totally unfounded and baseless, really, to be honest. We were expecting it, as were plenty of people, but it's still unfortunate, and it's sad that, given the fact that all the implications and complications that the designation will make, it will only make things worse for 85% of the Yemeni population.
The Yemen Solidarity Council put out a statement saying it would be ceasing all operations in the U.S. and putting a temporary hold on fundraising. How is this designation going to impact your work and humanitarian endeavors in Yemen?
Considering the fact that the Ansarullah, the popular liberation movement Ansarullah, is now on the U.S. Foreign terrorist organization list, we cannot continue operating in the United States specifically, because we are in fact enjoying of a very intimate mutual relationship with the authorities in the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. So already there you could see complications with us doing any work in the United States, because we would be liable to prosecution.
In the statement that was released by Mike Pompeo, it says the United States will make an exemption for relief agencies and humanitarian work, but they said the same thing about Syria, and we know how that turned out. So do you think this exemption will actually translate into reality, especially given that most food in Yemen is imported?
That's a good question, actually. The Department of the Treasury recently released a bunch of documents detailing these exemptions. But we find them totally useless and doesn't correspond nor translate into reality, dealing with what is needed at the moment for the Yemeni people. So the exemptions are totally useless. We cannot possibly, as if the Red Cross and Save the Children and Doctors Without Borders have been criticizing the designation and the subsequent exemptions that have now been released and made public.
What do you expect to see from the Biden administration, given that Joe Biden has been inaugurated, his Secretary of State Blinken has been confirmed? They said that they would be reviewing this designation. Do you have any hope in regards to that being overturned, and how hard is it to actually get that removed?
The designation being overturned, simple as. That is all we are demanding, and that is all we are hoping for now, because, as I've mentioned previously, this designation is based on unfounded and false accusations made in a vague attempt to push hard against Iran. That was the Trump administration's policy. But all it did was pushing hard on suffering Yemeni people that are already starving and have been starving for the past 5-6 years. So definitely overturn this designation, and we are skeptical of if Biden really withdraw U.S. support from the Saudi American coalition, because undoubtedly the war was a Biden-Obama war to begin with. But for a start, I think overturning this designation would prove helpful and useful to the suffering poor of the Yemeni population.
Why is that? Why are we seeing such negligence and lack of attention from the international community towards Yemen?
I think it has a lot to do with the media neglect of the war, the lack of coverage, the lack of adequate coverage. That is very important. We have been hearing a lot about the Saudi American coalition, quote-unquote, intervening in Yemen to... at some point, they make it seem like they're dropping bombs on Yemeni civilians, hospitals, and weddings to save Yemen from this perceived ghost of Iranian influence, when in fact the Iranian influence in Yemen is so minimal. It's highly over-dramatized and exaggerated to a point of it becoming obscure and dumb, in lack of a better word. The media organizations, the mainstream media conglomerates and corporations in the West have been not only failing to cover the war in Yemen from a somewhat objective standpoint, but they've also been getting a lot of, or basing a lot of their coverage on Saudi-paid, Saudi-funded narratives that the majority of Yemeni people fundamentally disagree with. So it has a lot to do with the narratives being spun on the war. There's a lot of false narratives, a lot of over-exaggerated narratives on the war currently.
In the statement from former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, he says that the United States has already given hundreds of millions of dollars in aid to the Yemeni people. I've also seen Saudi Arabia pledge some money. Isn't that a bit hypocritical when they're the ones bombing Yemen? What do you make of that?
The I think it's called the KSA Relief have been funding and driven this huge PR stunt to really show the world how good-hearted people they are and how much they are helping, and not only that, their military campaign is helping the Yemeni people, and their aid is helping the Yemeni people, and the US aid is also doing all sorts of stuff to help the starving poor of the Yemeni people. Fact of the matter is that the majority Yemeni population, that is 85%, they don't see just one centimeter, just one ounce of any of this aid that is supposedly being donated to them out of supposed goodwill and good-heartedness. A lot of the aid, a lot of the foreign aid is being donated to militia groups in occupied Aden and Hadramaut and all other Yemeni or Saudi-occupied Yemeni regions. And most of these funds and most of the aid goes to wealthy warlords that have been terrorizing the local population for 6 years now in the occupied territories. Yemeni intelligence found a huge weapon cache of foreign weapons and missile systems and rocket-propelled grenades bearing the USA logos, meaning, of course, as concluded by the Yemeni intelligence director, that the USAID claims to be giving humanitarian aid to the Yemeni people while really funneling arms and money into known terrorist groups that have been blacklisted practically everywhere. So it's a farce. It's a way for the occupiers and the aggressors to say, oh, we might be bombing your weddings, we might be destroying your homes, or bombing your funerals, or bombing your water sanitation systems, or bombing your critical infrastructure, or bombing your precious farms. But hey, we give you tons of money in aid and humanitarian donations. It doesn't add up, and any people with just the tiniest of peanut brains would understand that it doesn't make sense, and it's most likely a lie, a flat-out lie to continue legitimizing military aggression on innocent people.
Thanks so much for coming on. It's a pleasure speaking with you.
It's a pleasure to be joining you.
The Biden administration has indicated that it would possibly review the terrorist designation. However, in order to remove it, this would be quite difficult for Biden, and his cabinet would have to make the case for the Houthi movement, something that doesn't seem too likely, in all honesty. However, we all know that if the U.S. is really bent on doing something, they'll get it done. If the Biden administration is prepared to see thousands of Yemenis dying of starvation, and they're okay with that, and don't do everything within their power to prevent it, then this will be an indictment on them. We shouldn't forget that this conflict began during the Obama years when Biden was vice president. He, along with many members of his cabinet, who were also in government at the time, must be held accountable for this. For them to come around now after all these years and pretend to care is not something I really believe, nor have they really expressed any real remorse or commitment to ending support for Saudi Arabia and helping the Yemeni people rebuild. Just to give you one example, Avril Haines, who Biden appointed as National Director of Intelligence, she used to be the Deputy Director of the CIA under Obama. She also helped author the legal framework for Obama's drone program, killing scores of civilians, many of them in Yemen. It is truly imperative that something be done about this situation in Yemen. Not only has the United States and its allies sold weapons to Saudi Arabia and helped them commit genocide in Yemen, but the U.S. has really put the final nail in the coffin with this latest terrorist designation. This move accomplishes absolutely nothing except inflicting more suffering on the Yemeni people. It is a cruel, sadistic move, and typical for someone like Mike Pompeo, who spent the majority of his time as Secretary of State slapping Iran, Syria, and Venezuela with more sanctions than one can fathom as part of Trump's maximum pressure campaign, which, again, accomplishes nothing and only ends up inflicting immeasurable suffering on the innocent all over the world. The war in Yemen and the humanitarian crisis that has come about as a result of this armed conflict is an indictment on all the countries who supported this Saudi-led genocide. What does it say about the world if we allow this to continue? It is really difficult to encapsulate just how horrified and disgusted I am by this war and the humanitarian situation that has ensued. The hands of the United Kingdom, the United States, France, Germany, Saudi Arabia, Canada, they are covered in blood. What is happening in Yemen is absolutely disgraceful, and we must never forget the leaders who enabled and fueled this disaster, and equally, those who stood idly by and did nothing when they could and should have. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
www.parstoday.com/en What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Imam Khomeini, beloved leader. Of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, today is the first day of the 10 days dawn, which marks the period in which the Islamic revolution of the Iranian people triumphed over the oppressive Pahlavi regime and put an end to 2,500 years of tyranny and oppression for good. 12 of Bahman, or February 1st, 1979, was the day on which the beloved leader of the Iranian people, Imam Khomeini, returned home from exile and accelerated the struggles against the remnants of the regime. Stay tuned for the first episode of this series, which deals briefly with the character of the Imam and the unmatched love of the people towards him. Imam Khomeini returned home after 15 years of exile with indescribable glory and magnanimity. When his plane landed, hearts started to beat strongly as people were impatiently waiting to meet their beloved leader. The distance of Mehrabad Airport to Behesht-e-Zahra Cemetery had been ornamented with flowers, and people were standing in several kilometers to see him. As the door of the Boeing 747 opened, Imam Khomeini appeared on the steps, as if rain was falling on thirsty souls. Ruhullah came, and a new chapter began. The Iranian nation found the call of truth in Imam's voice. They really felt that he was honest in fighting injustice and corruption. They saw that a man of Imam Hussein's descent had come to revive religious values even at the cost of his life and captivity of his family. That's why they accepted his call and struggled against tyranny and sacrificed their life in his way. The Islamic Revolution shone like a sun on dormant hearts and breathed new spirit in the corpse of society which had become wary of oppression, discrimination, corruption, and evil. Since day one, Imam Khomeini taught the people that to cry the motto of independence, freedom, and Islamic Republic on the basis of the principle of neither East nor West, Islamic is the best. Sayyid Murtaza Avini, whom Ayatollah Khamenei called as the master of the men of letters, described Imam Khomeini in one of his books as follows. Imam Khomeini was not a new messenger, but he was among the reminders, who reminded people of their innate covenant with God. And after centuries of mankind's collective decadence, just like his predecessors, Abraham, Ishmael, and Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, broke an era of ignorance and initiated another era. Dear friends, Imam Khomeini, like his pure forefathers, was in pursuit of training and expurgation of individuals and society. God makes it clear in the Quran that government and politics are not separate from morality and human virtues. Verse 21 of chapter Ahzab reads, "In the apostle of Allah there is certainly for you a good exemplar." Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, was the best role model of an Islamic governor. After him, Imam Ali, peace be upon him, demonstrated the most beautiful manifestations of social justice and human magnanimity in the Islamic governance. Imam Khomeini too strove to revive and promote religious values in society. He possessed the lofty merits of an Islamic ruler himself. Since his adolescence, he had tried hard to train his soul in full conformity with moralities and piety. His classmates and friends all testified that he was an embodiment of human virtues. they focused on two characteristics in the Imam, namely midnight vigil for prayer and supplication at the divine court and serious refraining from backbiting or listening to backbiting. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, was a very truthful and honest man. He was an example of Imam Ali's word. Honesty is the strongest support of faith. Whatever Imam Khomeini preached, he would do it himself. If he advised the officials to lead a simple life, he had a simple life himself. In fact, his honesty was the main factor for people's endless love for him. Imam Khomeini would say, "If you call me servant, it would be better than calling me leader." Imam Khomeini would pay a lot of attention to the poor and the deprived classes. He used to remind the officials to be at the service of the poor and the oppressed. Once he said, "It is our duty and the duty of all officials to serve these people and share their sorrows, happiness, and problems. I don't think there is any worship better than serving the deprived." Ayatollah Khamenei says, "There were three beliefs in the Imam which gave him decisiveness, courage, and steadfastness. The belief in God, the belief in people, and the belief in himself. These three beliefs were manifest in the true sense of the word, in being Imam and all his moves." Dear listeners, Imam Khomeini was a real Gnostic, but he had not isolated himself from the society. He was in the middle of developments and enjoyed a very high political acumen. He was a very charismatic, disciplinary, and orderly figure. Since his youth, he had prepared a table for his daily affairs and had arranged his hours in an exact order. His pupils and classmates say that he was so orderly and on time that they could say the hour according to his activities. One of his daughters, Zahra Mustafavi, says, "The Imam was so exact and orderly that if he delayed 5 minutes for lunch, everybody at home would be worried." Let us end this program with the remarks of Ayatollah Khamenei on Imam Khomeini. "The reason why a word of our great Imam had an astonishing impact on the vast atmosphere of the country was his spirituality, his inward purity, his bond and connection with God, his midnight tears. That iron man, the man who would not move by events and harms which could move a nation, the man in whose eyes the awe and pomp of the global powers were not, used to shed tears humbly before the divine greatness."
Around the World with Reporters.
Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says it is the duty of the U.S. to return to the 2015 nuclear deal and fulfill its obligations under the accord. In a joint press conference with his Turkish counterpart, Zarif underlined that the moment the United States fulfills its commitments, Iran would be prepared to fulfill ours.
It is the duty of the United States to return to this agreement and to fulfill its obligations. The moment the United States fulfills its commitments, we would prepare to fulfill ours.
Zarif also denounced a U.S. decision last month to slap sanctions on Turkey over the country's purchase of the S-400 Russian air defense system. He said the sanctions have no significance. Elsewhere in his remarks, Zarif hailed relations with Turkey, noting that ties will deepen when the U.S. adopts more reasonable attitudes. For his part, Cavusoglu said Turkey has always supported the nuclear deal, expressing the hope that the Biden administration would return to the JCPOA and lift sanctions on Iran.
Iran, ABD.
I hope that with the Biden administration, the United States' return to this agreement and cooperation on the nuclear issue is restored. In this way, God willing, the sanctions and embargoes imposed on brotherly Iran are lifted.
Zarif arrived in Turkey as part of a tour of countries of the South Caucasus, aimed at building support for the creation of a regional platform that would include Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia, Iran, Russia, and Turkey, and encourage cooperation between the countries. The initiative was proposed following a ceasefire agreement in November that halted weeks of conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan over the separatist territory of Nagorno-Karabakh.
I think the meeting was very important. Both sides have a lot in common and many issues were discussed regionally and economically. The most important issue on the agenda was the Iran nuclear deal. And now with the new U.S. administration, there is a hope for this deal to be revived.
Zarif also met with Turkish President Erdogan, where the two discussed expansion of bilateral ties, as well as regional cooperation in Syria, Iraq, Caucasus, and ways to restore stability in the region through synergy. This meeting is seen by many as a door to open negotiations between Turkey and the U.S. to revive the 2015 nuclear deal. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Public and private sector workers staged a nationwide 24-hour general strike to denounce government measures adopted to counter the spread of coronavirus disease in Italy. The industrial action, called by the Confederation of Base Unions, COBAS, was joined by public servants and self-employed workers in several cities, including Milan, Rome, and Naples. In a note, unions have explained that the ongoing health crisis has exacerbated a structural crisis of the capitalist economy with a generalized impoverishment and a worsening of living conditions for millions of male and female workers. Also, students and teachers of Italian high schools held rallies in Rome and other cities, demanding a prompt return to the classroom after almost 10 months of remote learning.
We are staging a protest to reiterate that schools must be a priority in this country. Just a small amount of the recovery fund is destined to the school system. Students are sick and tired of distance learning and are dropping out of schools. Many are falling victim to depression.
Students across Italy have been holding demonstrations, open-air lessons and strikes in protest over the adoption of the distance learning policy by the government in response to a second wave of COVID-19 in October. About 10 million students have been affected by coronavirus restrictions in Italy, while schools have remained open in most European countries.
We demand more classrooms, transport to school and better access to education. Distance learning is not working. Many families cannot afford providing digital devices to their children to attend internet lessons regularly. Our families get poorer by the day as our parents lose their jobs.
As if the COVID crisis and its grave effects on the Italians weren't enough, Italy has also been hit by a political crisis with Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte resigning earlier this week, forcing the country's head of state to start a round of formal consultations with all political groups to establish if a new government majority can be formed.
Talks between Italy's President Sergio Mattarella and party leaders to resolve the government crisis concluded on Friday. with a country on the brink of a crashing socio-economic failure, President Mattarella must now decide on the way forward and ensure Italy a new government. Max Civili, Rome.
Israeli occupation has denied COVID-19 vaccine to Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Israeli parliament said Palestinians living under Israeli blockade in the Gaza Strip will receive no vaccine. Palestinians say the move is aimed at pressurizing resistance groups to release Israeli soldiers arrested during the Israeli aggression imposed against the Strip since 2014.
Israel's aggressive policies are unacceptable, and Palestinians will resist these inhumane policies. The Israeli announcement to deny vaccines to Gaza is totally unacceptable. The resistance groups will remain steadfast in their fight against the occupation and have prepared themselves for all possible scenarios.
This comes as Israeli Health Ministry has said over a quarter of Israel's population have received the vaccine since December 19. Human rights groups have accused Israeli regime of violating the basic rights of Palestinians.
Since the coronavirus outbreak in the Gaza Strip, Israeli regime has sought through all possible means to pressurize the resistance groups into sitting back. Israel has announced that no aid is allowed in the Gaza Strip without the release of their captured soldiers. Palestinians will never accept such a thing, and the Israeli occupation knows this well. Israel is now showing its racist face to the world by announcing this illegal and inhumane policy.
For their own part, Palestinian resistance groups in the Strip have said they will not sit back, adding release of Israeli soldiers should come through a just prisoner swap deal.
We announced that Israeli attempts to pressurize the resistance front into releasing its captured soldiers won't succeed. We are after a fair swap deal. We won't give in to pressure. Israel's attempts to tie vaccine entrance to soldier release will fail.
Earlier, the United Nations called on the Israeli regime to help ensure Palestinians will receive COVID-19 vaccinations amid the coronavirus pandemic, stressing that the pandemic has taken a heavy toll on the occupied Palestinian territories. The UN said the cost of lives and livelihoods there remain high, particularly in the Gaza Strip.
Israel's move to deny vaccine to the Palestinians comes as over 156,000 Palestinians have been infected with coronavirus and more than 1,800 have lost their lives so far. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Joint military drills involving the U.S. and South Korea are scheduled to go ahead this spring, says South Korea's Minister of Defense and military officials under U.S. President Joe Biden. But nearly 400 NGOs around the world have signed a joint statement calling for the drills to be scrapped in the hopes of improving relations with North Korea and promoting a lasting peace. The annual exercises, some of which are computer-simulated war games, are viewed by Pyongyang as a threat and a rehearsal for invasion. The joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises have been suspended before in the early 1990s as Washington sought to improve relations with Pyongyang. Previous U.S. President Donald Trump also scaled back the drills following his first summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in 2018. The North's Kim then pledged to suspend nuclear and long-range missile testing, with subsequent meetings between Kim and Trump failing to yield results or much for North Korea in return for its moratorium. U.S.-led sanctions against Pyongyang remain in place. South Korea keeps buying more advanced U.S. weapons, and now more military exercises are planned. Some activists view the war drills as counterproductive.
These South Korea-U.S. joint exercises fail to contribute to maintaining peace. Rather, it has been conducted in a way that threatens peace on the Korean Peninsula. It's not even more important because it's the beginning of the new Biden government in the United States and what signals can give to North Korea at this point.
North Korea has continued developing other military technologies, introducing a submarine-launched ballistic missile at a recent military parade. While seemingly committed to the drills, new U.S. officials have said they're reviewing North Korea policy, as experts call on Pyongyang to be patient. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Will Switzerland ban the burqa? That is the question being asked by many Swiss Muslims ahead of an upcoming referendum, which seeks a total ban on all face coverings in public. If successful, Muslim women who wear Islamic face veils will be banned from doing so after March the 7th.
Now, the text in the proposal doesn't mention Muslim face veils per se, only stating that no one shall wear face coverings in public spaces. However, the group behind the proposal includes members of right-wing political parties who were behind the already successful bid to ban Islamic minarets from being erected across the country in 2009.
In response, local Muslim activists have begun a Save the Niqab campaign to challenge the hate.
Islamophobia is as spread in Switzerland as everywhere in Europe. We know that there is a realistic chance for the niqab ban to be passed.
A representative explained why the ban would set a dangerous precedent.
Since the referendum was already signed by more than 100,000 voters to be even admitted at the to the ballot, and a recent poll suggests that 64% of voters will vote in favor of a ban, the law is highly to be passed. Adding such an Islamophobic and discriminatory ban to the Swiss constitution, which dictates to women how they should dress, exposes Switzerland to internal, or I would say international ridicule, and fundamentally contradicts the liberal and pluralistic values that this country is so fond of propagating. And if we were to ban everything that might been out of force, then we would most likely ban a lot of things, and not only the niqab.
Islamophobia has penetrated deep into Swiss society, with a recent poll finding that 63% of those questioned would vote in favour of a burqa ban, leaving Swiss Muslims with little hope. Robert Carter, London.
The American aggression and the blockade on Yemen are terrorist crimes is the motto of a press conference held by the Intisaf Organization for the Rights of Women and the Children. The conference highlighted the crimes and violations committed by the Saudi-led coalition against Yemeni children and women with American support.
The crimes and violations committed by the U.S. against the people of Yemen are too many and cannot be counted. There is, for example, the crime of targeting children in Dahyan in Sada, and the crime of targeting women in weddings in Wajiha, Ahrab, and Samban, and these are war crimes for sure.
The Minister of Human Rights said that designating Ansarullah as a terrorist organization confirms that the American participation went beyond arms sales, military and logistical support, and reached providing political cover and justifying the crimes of its Saudi ally.
The classification of Ansarullah as a terrorist organization is an American green light for Saudi Arabia to continue its aggression against Yemen, and also to feed terrorism and terrorist groups, as happened in Al-Baidah, when the Yemeni army found weapons with the logo of the United States Agency for International Development, and also for the sake of covering and evading its crimes in Yemen.
The Saudi war on Yemen has killed hundreds of thousands of people and displaced millions of others. The country is suffering from a humanitarian situation that was described by the United Nations as the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Yemenis unanimously agree that the U.S. is a major complicit in the war crimes committed against Yemeni children and women, which necessitates placing its name on the top of the list of states sponsoring terrorism. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana.
The UK has used slogans to raise awareness during the pandemic. One of its most popular is Stay Home, Protect the NHS, save lives. Some government messaging has been comforting as well as informative, but it's become more and more intense, with TV ads showing people dying and incessant radio ads claiming joggers and people working outdoors are highly likely to have the disease.
Stick to the rules. If you bend the rules, people will die. Stay home, protect the NHS.
The government is now under pressure to pull this ad after Number 10 was condemned by MPs and public health experts for spreading false information. Parents worry they will affect their children. Surely this messaging could be really damaging to vulnerable people and is irresponsible. Telling 5-year-olds if someone bends the rules, people will die seems really inappropriate. We need sensible messaging. They should not be saying people will die. We are heading for a huge mental health crisis in this country. And experts agree. 10 of the UK's top experts in child health say anxiety, self-harm, and suicidal thoughts have reached frightening levels among children. Paediatricians are urging the government to reopen schools or risk a calamitous impact on children's mental health. Boris Johnson says he understands the concerns surrounding the mental health of young people, but it all relies on the vaccine.
If we achieve our target of vaccinating everyone in the four most vulnerable groups with their first dose by the 15th of February, and every passing day sees more progress towards that goal, then those groups that have developed immunity from the virus about 3 weeks later, that is by the 8th of March, we hope it will therefore be safe to begin the reopening of schools from Monday the 8th of March.
Adults themselves are struggling. There has been a surge in people afraid to leave the house. Alcohol consumption has gone up, and helplines say calls regarding domestic abuse have increased many times over.
Health services in the UK say as a result of the pandemic, at least 10 million people are going to need some form of mental health support. And with no real end in sight for the lockdowns and the virus itself, more and more people are losing hope. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Iranian cultural figures, artists from different countries as well as envoys of the foreign states attended the closing ceremony of the biggest calligraphy event, which was held in Jondi Shapur Library west of Tehran. Some of the artists also performed calligraphy live while the audience could watch their expertise. The exhibition aims at convening countries which have olden historical civilizations. Artworks from Silk Road countries including Pakistan, Egypt, India, Tajikistan, Iraq, Tunisia, Algeria, and Afghanistan were put on show both virtually and also physically with limited number of visitors due to the pandemic. The organizers noted that as the works were in different languages, it was not possible to judge them.
Iranian National Commission for UNESCO decided to hold this festival to enhance cultural proximity among countries. We started the preliminary phases since 1.5 years ago. Almost 1,000 works from different countries were received by the Secretariat. As the works were written in different languages, we could not judge them. So we decided to choose the winners randomly.
Veteran calligraphers also noted that calligraphy is a heritage that must always be preserved. Calligraphy works by 203 artists from 30 countries have been showcased in the exhibition, which officially opened on January 20th in the northeastern Iranian city of Mashhad, Humayun Abadi, Tehran.
With the new U.S. administration taking the helm at the White House, many express optimism that the 2015 Iran nuclear deal will be back on the board. But comments by U.S. officials have raised doubts over the optimism. On Thursday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Washington will meet its commitments under the Iran nuclear deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, only after Tehran returns to full compliance with the JCPOA. Blinken said the U.S. wants to start meeting its obligations again, but Iran needs to act first. He said Washington would seek to build a longer and stronger accord to address what he called deeply problematic issues. He, however, noted that it will take a long time for the U.S. to return to the deal. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif was quick to react, saying it is the United States that should return to its obligations under the 2015 Iran nuclear deal first. Zarif recalled it was Washington who violated the nuclear agreement, prevented supplies of food and medicine to Iran, and punished countries which abided by UN Security Council Resolution 2231. Therefore, it's the U.S. that should take the first step. Former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled his country out of the JCPOA in May 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Tehran as part of his so-called maximum pressure policy against the Islamic Republic. Iran waited for a year and gave leeway to the European signatories, Britain, France, and Germany, to make up for the U.S. move. They, however, failed to live up to their commitments. Iran then reacted by scaling back on its commitments under the accord. Tehran says it has lost trust in the Western members of the deal, and it will only revoke its measures after the U.S. removes its sanctions. On Tuesday, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov echoed a similar position, stressing that the United States must remove its sanctions against Iran and comply with the 2015 nuclear deal, as it was Washington that withdrew from the accord. Some experts say Biden has been a warmonger and is not going to return into a pacifist overnight.
I mean, the point being that virtually everything he has done has been imperialist. He's a chief warmonger for the U.S. government. He is not going to turn into a pacifist and a logical statesman who cares about the well-being of people in the world. I mean, he's just never done that. And he's always been intimate with the defense industry. He has long-standing ties with the defense industry.
With the Biden administration not showing any practical and real interest in returning to the deal, questions arise as whether he will follow in his predecessor's track and maintain his anti-Iran pressure campaign, or will it put an end to its malign policy against Tehran, as Iran foreign minister put it. Iran, on the other hand, says the window of opportunity is closing very fast.
The steadfastness of Yemen and the resistance of Palestinians is the slogan of a press conference held by the Yemen-Palestine Organization. Participants discussed Yemeni-Palestinian relations and their common vision, which is resistance against the Zionist projects in the region.
This event is a Yemeni-Palestinian initiative for political awakening and for the unity of both nations to achieve a common goal of defeating the Israeli regime's plans in the region and liberation of Palestine. Israel is our common enemy and the enemy of Muslim nations.
The participants affirmed that Yemen and Palestine have strong ties that transcend geographical borders, as Yemen has become an important part of the axis of resistance. The Yemen-Palestine Organization also revealed its humanitarian plan for 2021, which will contribute to alleviating the suffering of Yemenis due to the continuing war and the blockade imposed by the U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition.
Yemenis believe that the U.S. as the main supporter of Israel is also responsible for the sufferings of Palestinians and Yemenis. They say resistance is the only way to achieve victory and liberation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The necessity to observe health protocols and the regulations announced by the anti-corona headquarters during Muharram mourning occasions.
This is part of a televised speech delivered on July 31, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Eid al-Adha.
I wish to say something about Muharram. there are many debates about Muharram. People have been speaking about Muharram for a long time. Well, they will hold the mourning ceremonies one way or another. But what I want to stress is that in the mourning ceremonies, the main criteria is what medical experts, the National Anti-Corona Headquarters, announced to us. I myself will observe whatever action they deem necessary. My firm recommendation to all those who wish to participate in the mourning ceremonies, including mourning committees, those who take the minbar, the organizer, panegyrists, performers of eulogies, and the like, is this. Before you do anything, you should see what they say.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, my Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
If the National Anti-Corona Headquarters issues certain regulations for these occasions, all of us will have a duty to observe them. The issue is not a minor issue. Rather, it is a very important one. In the present time, there is supervision and control to some extent. However, if God forbid, these measures are taken lightly, and if people do not observe them, then there will be a disaster with unclear consequences at the end. I hope that Allah the Exalted will help. I hope that Imam of the Age, may our souls be sacrificed for his sake, will take our hands and rush to our help, as has always been the case. I hope that the pure souls of martyrs and the immaculate soul of our late Imam, may God bestow paradise on him, will pray for us and ask God to bestow success on the Iranian nation, God willing. Greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
Aperture. Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we witnessed that abuse by law enforcement officers in the United States is one of the most serious and divisive human rights violations in the country, as U.S. police is killing black people at persistently high rates. What is clear is that racism is at the very heart of the issue, as statistics show that black people are 3 times more likely to be killed by police than white people. What is worse is that even black children are being targeted. Yet the people have not been silent. They have organized in what is known as the Black Lives Matter campaign to get the message across that all lives are of equal value, no matter the color of the skin.